Hallo und herzlich willkommen zum Aktiengramm-Podcast. Heute gibt es mal wieder ein Interview und auch Videoformat mit niemand Geringerem als dem Europachef von Van Eck. Wir haben das Interview auf Englisch geführt und wir sprechen unter anderem über den Weg von Martin als Hochfrequenzhändler zum Thema ETFs und auch über Themen wie, was passiert, wenn ein ETF geschlossen wird, wie oft kommt das bei Van Eck vor und noch viele weitere spannende Themen. Und jetzt viel Spaß mit der Folge. Hi Martin, nice to see you.
Hi Lisa.
So I wanted to ask you some questions and we will start with the topic about how did you start your journey on investing and how did you get in touch with the stock market?
Yeah, I think for me it was quite early. I was 18 years old when I went to university. And in the first intro week, I met these guys. They were sitting on a lawn. They had some beer. I may have been persuaded by the beer, but it turned out they were an investment society. And so they were dealing with investing in stocks, but also options. So the more exciting part of investing. And I thought it was quite cool. So I became a member, and that's how it got started.
And do you remember what was the first? Yeah, maybe the first shares you bought in this time, or was it already the more risky products?
I have to admit it was more risky product.
Okay.
and I think it's probably a good thing to do risky stuff when you're not wealthy and only have a limited amount to invest. But my first investment was actually a warrant.
Mm-hmm.
It was a warrant on a Dutch bank, ING, but you also know it in Germany as ING DiBa. These warrants, I think they were around 2 guilders when I bought them, which translates to about 1 euro. And the fun thing about a warrant is that it's sort of leveraged. It worked. I think I sold them around 3.5, maybe 4 guilders. So sort of almost doubling my money. So I was really happy.
Okay. And then did you also experience some fails where you just learned a lot, maybe? Can you tell
yes.
me something? Yeah.
Yeah, of course. I think, well, during my my university years, actually I was quite lucky, maybe also because I was really disciplined. So I think in that period I did not have many fails. The biggest fail that I had was actually when I had already started working, and maybe we'll touch upon my job later on, but let's not spoil that now. But when I was already working and I had a little bit more money, I bought shares in a local company called Ahold,
mm-hmm.
which is they're quite big in the Netherlands, and at the time they were also quite big in the USA. And after buying the shares, I think it took a couple of months, it turned out they were in a bankruptcy or some sort of bookkeeping scandal in the US. So the stock went down quite a bit. And that's basically when I learned that if you only invest or have most of your assets in one company, then it can be quite dangerous.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so in Germany, it's kind of known that the financial education is really a topic that is, very not common. How is it, or how is your experience? Did you experience financial education while growing up or maybe at a school?
Unfortunately, not so much. I think in the Dutch education system, finance is not very highlighted, not even common household finance, but certainly not investing. And I think it's a shame. I've sort of experienced it when I was younger, but I also see it with my own kids, that they don't get a lot or any information on financial education. So luckily there are some initiatives, and actually we're part of some of those as well, on a project basis to do education for people in high school on investing, but it's the minority, and it's simply some schools, they want to be involved, but a lot of them, they don't. So I think on average, people in the Netherlands, they don't really get a good education on both household finance and especially not on investments.
Okay, so maybe it's kind of the same like in Germany. Do you have some experience, some tips, like how do you get your kids in touch with the topic? Do you have maybe some learnings you can share?
Yeah, maybe one or two. Well, first of all, I force them, of course. I'm a really tough parent. No, actually, it's more the opposite. They don't really, especially in the beginning, they did not really care. But so the one thing that got them involved a little bit was that they were saving already. So they knew it was wise to put some of your money away for when you need it. And then I showed them a couple of our ETFs that were really sort of well diversified. So we have a couple of ETFs that have both equity, bonds, real estate. They're like sort of model portfolios in one ETF. So I showed to them that these don't really move that much. They're not really risky. And so yeah, they started using those like a little bit. Mm-hmm. And then a couple of years back, we launched an ETF on video gaming and esports.
Yeah.
And that was the one that really got them interested, because that's for the first time they really understood the business model of the companies behind it. So they knew that they were doing these in-game purchases and they were spending money on games. So they got it a little bit. So that for me is yeah, it worked to get younger audience, not only my kids, but in broader, a younger audience interested in investing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, interesting. Great idea. I didn't think about this in the way of ETFs. Like, I'm always trying to connect it, like, what products do you know from your daily basis? And maybe what video games do you know? Or one of the examples is maybe Minecraft, like Microsoft shares, and there you can get this connection. But ETF is a good point too. Yeah.
It does help. And it also helps to explain to young people that, well, one of the mistakes I made, just invest too much in one company. Mm-hmm. If you use the ETF, you don't have to pick whether you want to invest in Nintendo or Sony or Microsoft. You can just basically buy all of them in one basket.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so maybe let's get a little bit back to your story. Like, how did you decide to start working in this field, like high frequency trading? Or maybe you can first explain it a little bit, like what is the kind of job you did there?
Okay, cool. Yeah, I think it's sort of a funny story. So when I was in university with the Investment Society, at some point, I was part of the options committee. So we mm-hmm. traded option contracts. And I thought it was really fascinating because obviously it moved quite a bit and it was exciting. And so when I sort of was at the end of my education, I got advice from someone who said, before you go and do a real job interview, you should probably practice one or two companies that you don't really want to work, but that you maybe find interesting enough to have a conversation with. And I did. So one of the first companies that I went for a job interview with was actually a company that was trading on the options exchange. Mm-hmm. And I figured I know a thing or two about options, so that's probably interesting. And so I went for a practice interview. But it turned out to be really interesting. And then I had a second interview, and then they offered me the job. And I decided, well, I can probably do this for maybe 1 or 2 years. Well, and basically the rest is history, because I took the job. I stayed there a lot longer than 1 or 2 years. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I really learned so much about financial markets and financial products that yeah, it was never a dull moment. And this was sort of end of the 90s. Mm-hmm. So it was also very exciting times where, well, we had sort of the millennium bug thing where I'm not sure if people remember, but I know you come from the IT background, so you probably definitely know what I'm talking about. And it turned out to be a big non-event because nothing really happened. And then we had the change from all the local European currencies to the euro, which was also a big thing. And then we went from floor trading to screen trading.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe to explain briefly, floor trading was when you saw all these guys with the colorful jackets and they were riding trades on tickets. Mm-hmm. And it always looked really frantic. And all of a sudden that stopped and we all went to sitting behind screens. Actually, a lot of them, there were most traders had like 6 or 8 screens. So yeah, it was a really interesting period where I did learn quite a bit. Mm-hmm. And yeah, that was basically my start in the financial world.
Great, great story. And so you really got the whole experience about this, yeah, these changes in the market, like from this writing stuff to the totally opposite of the market. Then I found out that 2009, you started your first ETF provider, Think ETF. How is the connection about high frequency trading to ETFs? Like, can you explain that maybe?
Yeah, it's a big step. Well, first of all, I think trading is very different from investing, and being a trader is also very different from building investment products. But to me, it was sort of logical because after the high frequency trading job, I took a sabbatical. And during the sabbatical, I started to look at my own investments with a little bit more time on my hands. I could look into more detail. And basically what I found is that I had, well, some of my funds managed by the bank. And what they did was basically buy expensive mutual funds that didn't really add too much value. So I became more interested in ETFs. And at that time, I already knew about ETFs because we were trading them as well. So I thought, hey, why don't I use these ETFs more? Because they're way cheaper. They have good diversification. And so I started doing that. But then I also noticed, and this is especially for Dutch investors and some other European investors, but for, let's say, our local index, there was a big US ETF provider that had a local index ETF in the Netherlands. But if I bought it, I lost the opportunity to reclaim my dividend tax. And to me, that was a little bit annoying because I was sort of growing really fond of ETFs and I liked them a lot. But I thought, how come that I still have to sort of, well, lose my dividend tax? Why don't they fix that? And that is basically when I started looking into, could I fix this? And that ended into, well, Think ETFs. So this is basically the main reason why I started Think ETFs. And yeah, we started in 2009, at least formally, but it took obviously a lot of work. I think it was already end of 2007, early 2008 that we started building the company. But yeah, there's a lot of regulatory stuff that you need to take care of. And in all honesty, I'm always a very optimistic person. I sort of tend to become really enthusiastic quickly, and then only later to find out that it's usually a lot harder than I thought at first. But in the end, yeah, luckily we managed to set up the company, and it was a great experience. Also one that was very frustrating at times because, yeah, I think I underestimated a little bit how difficult it is to do the distribution part. So building and structuring the ETFs, that wasn't so difficult. It was more the marketing and sales part of it that was quite difficult, especially because in those days, it was really common for banks and brokers to get sort of a distribution fee or a kickback from suppliers of investment products. And my goal was to have really transparent and really cost-efficient products. But that also meant that I did not have any money to hand out to banks or brokers to basically pay them to sell to their clients. And also, I thought it was a really strange system because how can someone be really objective and give clients really good advice if that person takes money from, well, whoever builds the product? So it was a bit of a strange situation at first, but yeah, well, here we are 15 years later and it worked.
Did you experience like you were one of the first companies regarding to ETFs? Like I think in those time, maybe it was kind of one of the early adapters and others followed you, or was it like you didn't even look at other sites?
Well, I did look a little bit of obviously to the existing ETF issuers because yeah, basically my way of thinking was if I can improve the products that they offer, I should have a good business case because yeah, why not buy better products if they are out there? So I certainly looked at that, but I also think in hindsight, I was so focused on this, well, business and getting it done that a lot of stuff that was happening sort of I neglect it a little bit, because sometimes, especially afterwards, people ask me, how could you start a business in 2008? It was like a financial crisis. The world was on fire. And you start a business in investment products? Are you crazy? But at the time, it didn't really sort of, yeah, I was building the business. I was maybe a little bit distracted. And it's only in hindsight that I sort of realized, yeah, it was a funny time to get started. But maybe also, I think probably for all businesses, if you can sort of start your business in a difficult time and survive, then yeah, you're well positioned for when things pick up. So I think maybe that's also a little bit of luck. And that's basically one of my, I would almost say mottos in life, that you should always realize that a lot of things that you achieve, you achieve by working hard, but you always need to be a little bit lucky as well. There's always sort of the random factor involved, and it's I'm not the type of person that would always claim to be sort of in control of my success. I'm sort of more the type of person that will say, well, I have to acknowledge that I was a little bit lucky here and there as well. So yeah, I guess this is one of those examples, because I needed to be a little bit lucky to be able to start a business in the midst of the financial crisis.
Okay. And Think ETF was later then acquired by VanEck. And this is kind of the situation today. So in my mind, VanEck is well known for the special theme ETFs like video gaming, esports, we mentioned that, or maybe space innovators I saw. So maybe can you explain like the mission about VanEck and how did this evolve?
Yeah, sure. I think when we were sort of in business for about 10 years, so 2017, 2018, two of our major shareholders, they were looking for an exit. So they wanted to sell their stake. And so we started talking to, well, a couple of the well-known ETF firms to see who would be interested in buying their stake. And I still remember when we got in touch with VanEck, I have to be honest, I didn't know them that well, because they weren't really active in Europe at the time. I had heard about GDX, gold miner ETF, but that was pretty much it. But then we got talking, and one of the things I really liked about those conversations is that, well, first of all the talks were with Jan VanEck himself. So it was really, he was really involved, really hands-on. Some of the other ETF firms, not so much. They would maybe have someone from management talk to us, but certainly not the CEO. And what I also really liked is getting to know VanEck as a family-owned business. And I think there's a lot of advantages there, because as a family-owned business, it's very entrepreneurial. They really showed a long-term perspective on things, long-term strategy. And to me, as an entrepreneur, that felt really good, because that was similar to the way I liked to run my business. So it was a really good match. And also, if you look at it from a product perspective, so VanEck, as you mentioned, they were known for the more special or thematic ETFs, where Think at the time was more focusing on the really, well, I always tell people, boring stuff. So we had really broad equity indices or bond ETFs, or even the example I mentioned earlier, sort of a model portfolio ETF where you have sort of a all-in-one solution. And I think for us, it was really great to be able to add the more special thematic ETFs. But for the VanEck people that were already working in Europe, it was also great to be able to add the more broader exposure ETFs. So it was a really good combination. I never regretted it for a second. So ever since early 2018, when I became part of VanEck, it's sort of, yeah, worked very well. And still here today, quite happy. So it's been a good move.
Sounds like a perfect match with the different product. And let's get to the topic of the products. Like, I wanted to ask, I don't know if you can tell that, but which one is the most favorite ETF of VanEck? Like, is it measured on the invested capital? Is it maybe more a wide product or maybe some special ETFs?
Well, it's almost like, you asking me which of your seven children is your favorite. That would also be a difficult question. And by the way, yes, I really have seven kids. but yeah, I think there's not one answer here. I think if you would look at AUM numbers, then yeah, there's a couple of ETFs that are more important to us because they are really big. For instance, the semiconductor ETF or video gaming and esports or GDX, all of them are several hundreds of millions, even closer to a billion. So that's important from a business perspective because in the end, obviously, we have a numbers game and our business model is basis points over the AUM, the assets under management. So yeah, products with more assets under management, they generate more revenue. So that's good for the firm. But I do have some other favorites as well. And that's mainly because I think we're not just in the business of selling ETFs to make money. We're also in the business of selling ETFs because they will enable smaller investors to build a better financial future. And that's something I really mean. I think that's really one of our intentions. And there's a lot to be done there because a lot of people think investing is really, scary or dangerous, and they're not very comfortable with it. And they're not looking for all sorts of special themes, but they need to find a solution that is like foolproof. And for that reason, I really like our multi-asset range. We have like the multi-asset ETFs that I mentioned already twice that offer someone the ability to just buy one product and then be invested in stocks, bonds, real estate. And they come in three risk sort of flavors. And I think those are very near to my heart because they're, amongst the first five products that we ever launched. Okay. And because they really offer a solution for someone that isn't per se interested in investing, but does want to put their money to work in a, safe and controlled way. So, if I really had to pick, then probably those would be my favorites.
Okay.
But from a business perspective, they're definitely not our biggest. So from a business perspective, it's maybe a little bit different. And then if you look purely at the name, or the ticker, you already mentioned it briefly. My favorite ticker by far is JEDI, our space ETF. So for all the Star Wars fans out there, the JEDI ticker is obviously a really nice one.
Okay, so maybe let's get a little bit more into the topic of ETF. Like, how does it work when you decide to start a new one? Is it who makes the decision? Who got the first idea? Is it kind of you get a meeting here and there? Or is it maybe a plan you make in the beginning of the year? Like, this year we want to make 10 new ETFs. How does it work?
Well, we're quite flexible there. There is never a sort of a fixed amount of ETFs that we want to do in a certain year. The way we deal with it is basically from a couple of perspectives. First of all, we have a product management department, and they are managing the products and they are also sort of scanning for new ideas. So most of the ideas basically come from this department, but it could be that they're sort of pointed to an idea by maybe someone from sales who spoke to a client, and the client said, hey, do you have an ETF on this or this exposure, and then we could start to think about it. And so it's usually not just one strategy or one way to come to an idea. It's basically, just keeping our eyes and ears open, seeing what's out there in the market, seeing what it is that clients are talking about. Also looking at our US colleagues, because the FinEC products, they differ in the sense that we have a US range. And for European investors, investing in US products is usually not possible because of European regulation. So for the European customers, we have the UCITS range. So we, especially in the beginning, obviously scanned the range for the US products and to see if there were some interesting ones that we could also use in Europe. Mm-hmm. So for example, the video gaming and esports ETF came from that direction, but also the semiconductor ETF, GDX, the gold miners. So mm-hmm. some of the products we basically made a European copy from a US okay. product, and some others we basically came up with ourselves, and there is not even a US counterpart, for instance, for the sustainable equal mm-hmm. weight ETF or our high dividend ETF. There's also no US version for it. So it's yeah, there's many ways to launch a new product.
Okay, and how does it work, or how do you decide if an ETF maybe has to be closed? Like, is there a measurement, like you can tell total asset under management, where you say this is not a profitable product, so we have to, how do you call it,
yeah, basically to stop the product,
to stop the product, close, yeah,
close the product,
to close.
Well, there's no real sort of formula for that, mm-hmm. but the way we look at it is this. I think with any new product that we launch, we should be able to, or should be willing to, at least have it live for 3 to 5 years. Mm-hmm. Because investing is something for the long term. It's not for short term. And I think we should at least set the example that if we launch a product, that we're willing to, well, have it at least for 3 to 5 years. And then after the 3 to 5 years, yeah, we'll definitely look at the AUM, because mm-hmm. in the end, that is sort of where we make the money. And as a ballpark figure, let's say that an ETF needs to be at least around 15 to 20 million for us to be interesting, or at least not loss making.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also not very black and white there, because from time to time, certain themes or certain assets are more in favor than other times.
Mm-hmm.
And if, let's say, over the last 5-6 years, fixed income ETFs weren't very popular, but if we would have closed all of them, then we would not have any fixed income ETFs now. Mm-hmm. And at this time, they are becoming more popular.
Yeah.
So I think, besides just looking at the AUM or looking at how long an ETF has been around, what we also do is look how well it fits within the total range. I think you should probably compare it to when you go into the supermarket.
Mm-hmm.
There's probably only a number of products that you're looking for, but if the shelves would be empty otherwise, you'd still, I don't know, be less incentivized to buy something.
Mm-hmm.
People like to have a certain amount of choice, and there's a balance there. So I think it's only logical that yeah, within any ETF issuer's product range, there will always be some products that are smaller or less popular, or
mm-hmm.
at least at that specific point in time. But you may still need them in years to come. So
mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's like that. But the one thing I think it's important that people know is that if we do launch a new product, you can at least be certain that we'll keep it at least for 3 to 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And even if we close it, and I'm not sure if this would have been your next question, but if it is, I'll just start answering it. If we do decide to close a product,
mm-hmm.
then obviously, we would have rather kept it open, but mm-hmm. if we have to close it, it's not a really big deal, because we will announce it like well ahead of time,
mm-hmm.
and people will have a choice either to sell the ETF on exchange and mm-hmm. buy something else, or if they don't sell it because, well, whatever reason, maybe they haven't seen the announcement or they want to wait. In the end, we would close the product
mm-hmm.
and then sell all the underlying assets, and people would simply get the money back through their bank or brokerage account.
Mm-hmm.
So
okay.
closing a product may sound really scary,
mm-hmm.
But it's not that scary, because one way or the other, you will always get your money back.
Mm-hmm.
And the one thing obviously that we would regret is that the investment idea that we wrapped in that ETF didn't catch on,
mm-hmm.
Which is too bad, but I think it's also something you could expect. I think it's impossible to only launch ETFs that will all become very successful.
Yeah.
Every
yeah.
now and then, there may be something that, for whatever reason, just doesn't become popular. And then, yeah, in the end, you have to close it.
Okay. And how is the time period about if you announce that some ETF will be closed in time X, how much time is there left to decide whether to sell it or maybe just wait? And maybe is there a risk that the value is falling because of the closing?
No, I think the as with any ETF, the value of an ETF is only impacted by the underlying market. Mm-hmm. So it's basically the value of all the shares or bonds in the ETF that will determine the value. So the closing itself doesn't impact the value. Mm-hmm. Off the top of my head, there is a period of a month, so 30 days before the actual closing.
Okay.
So I think usually that's should be sufficient time for people to make up their minds. But maybe to put in perspective, I think over the years we closed only two ETFs, and we currently have 40. So it doesn't happen that often. And in all honesty, there's actually one ETF that we closed about 2 years ago, I think, that in hindsight, I would have rather kept open. It an ETF on natural resources, something that, especially last year with the whole inflation theme, probably would have been interesting to have had at this time. But when we decided to close, it was quite small. No one was interested. And so, yeah, maybe in hindsight, the decision at the time was logical. But with the knowledge I have today, I would have probably kept it around.
Okay, interesting. And maybe to get a little bit to more of the global topic, like do you have some future plans? I'm sure you have them for OneEgg and maybe also for yourself. So maybe what are the next steps? You already mentioned you have 40 ETFs right now. Are there plans to get maybe not maybe this year, but in the next time some new thematic ETFs, or what is the next goal?
Yeah, we definitely have a couple of ETFs in the pipeline, as they say. I would love to tell you more about it, but then we would have to probably do it when they're almost launched. So maybe I think it will probably be around February next year.
Okay.
So the big thing about the thematic ETFs is that everyone always tries to be the first with a certain theme. And again, even if I really would have loved to tell you, I think maybe one of our competitors could be listening and or watching it. And then, let's keep that a little bit of secret now. But there are a couple of at least two or three ideas that we're currently working on. Hopefully, we'll have them live February, March. As soon as I can tell more about it, I will definitely let you know.
Great. And maybe another question with the kind of looking at the US market, like there are some trends with this active ETFs, like you don't have this fully, I don't know how to tell it, like...
You could say it in German. My German is reasonably well.
Okay. Also in dem US-Markt oder mit Blick auf den US-Markt, da ist ja so die Entwicklung, dass es aktive ETFs immer mehr gibt und auch dieser reine passive Ansatz quasi ein bisschen... ja, aufgebrochen wird. Ist das ein Thema für euch auch, wo ihr auch drauf schaut oder überlegt, vielleicht Produkte in diesem Bereich zu erstellen, also wo das aktive oder der aktive Ansatz auch ja einen Platz findet?
I think as a matter of fact, we have a couple of mutual funds also in Europe that are actively managed. So VanEck as a firm, they started in 1955 as an active manager. So let's say active investment strategies are part of our genes. But in all honesty, in Europe, we're much more successful with the passive ones. But it's funny you should ask. We actually have one ETF that has an active investment strategy. It's actually one of the other cool tickers, I think, because the ETF is something that we've built together with a big Dutch family office. They've always been they've been around for about 20 years now, and they've always really focused on sort of tech solutions. That they really feel that innovation is the driver behind most of the sort of economical value creation. So they've always had a keen eye for tech companies, and one of their themes or ideas was that the way that we use our home is changing over the last, well, 10 to 15 years. Houses become a lot smarter. And especially COVID showed us that there's a lot of stuff you can do from home, such as working, but also exercising, entertainment, maybe even generating your own electricity with solar panels on the roof. Well, there's a lot of things you can think about. And there's companies that benefit from that trend. And what they think is that this will be a trend that will be, well, continuing for quite some years to come. So they have an investment theory about smart home. And together with them, we built an ETF. It's the smart home ETF, and the ticker is CAVE, which basically, I think the German word will probably be Grotte, or a cave is something from the Flintstones for the older viewers. And so it's really the opposite of what it does. A cave is obviously not a very smart home. It's really rudimentary home, but it's a fun ETF. It's actively managed. It's our only active managed ETF. I have to be honest that the timing wasn't great so far, because ever since we launched it, with the rising interest rates, a lot of these tech companies actually performed quite badly. But then maybe the upside for that is that if you would think about such an investment, then since it's already down quite a bit, maybe, and obviously I'm not giving advice, but maybe now could be an interesting time to look at it. But it's interesting. And I think what we see in the US with more active strategies in ETFs, that is probably something we could see in Europe as well. And at least for one reason, I think a lot of active managers have come to realize that the structure of a mutual fund, where you can only buy once a day, has its limitations. And also the sort of price discovery with mutual funds is very limited. If you would wrap the investment idea in an ETF, then you'd still have the same active investment idea, but then you have a vehicle that is much easier to trade, because it has, like, you can trade it during the day. You don't have to wait until a certain moment. You can trade it at whatever price you want to trade at. There's you can put in a limit order instead of just a market order. So I think that's the reason that many active managers are these days also looking at the ETF as an instrument to wrap their investment idea in.
Okay, and how is the difference, like, if you choose one active ETF, like, is there this kind of management we know from active funds, like you have a little team, like maybe three or four people, and it's kind of the same, just with this component maybe?
It's very similar. And in our case, if we do an active ETF, as well, we did once, we would always work together with an external investment manager, because then they can do the active investment strategy, because that's not something that is our specialty. We are really good at making these passive ETFs, but an active management team we don't have in Europe. But we can work together with a partner that is really good at a certain active investment theme. And then basically they do all of the investment management, and we basically wrap it in an ETF. So it's a corporation or a joint venture. It's simply like that.
Okay. So, and back to the topic of the future plans, we mentioned VanEck. So maybe what are your personal plans for the future?
Well, I think that's a good question. Well, typically, I don't really plan ahead that much on, on a personal level, but yeah, I really enjoy myself. I think over the last, well, 5 years with VanEck, it's been great. So, well, if I have to say anything, I hope to be at least around for another 5 years, maybe 10 years. I think with my first meeting with VanEck, actually, in New York, in probably end of 2017, what I noticed that a lot of people at VanEck are there for many, many years. I think on average, it's well over 20. So maybe I'll just stick around until retirement. Who knows? That would probably probably mean another 18 years, but yeah, I could definitely see myself doing it. It's a lot of fun, and I think from what I said earlier, the sort of my philosophy or mission to get more European retail people involved in investing. I think there's still a lot of work to be done there, and hopefully, as Fnac, we can play a part in that. And yeah, then I think yeah, I could definitely use another 10 to 15 years to make that work.
Okay, maybe another question to the Dutch market on investing. Like in Germany, we got this neo brokers like Trade Republic, Scalable Capital, where you can really get easy and kind of cheap access to maybe on a monthly base, like making your investments on 25 euros or 50 euros without any order fee. Is this something you experienced in the Dutch market too in the last years?
Yes. Yeah, it's definitely something that is also starting to happen here. I think less so than in Germany. I think one of the great things about my current role is that I have sort of a pan-European perspective.
Okay.
So I can really see what's happening in the different countries. And I think Germany is well ahead of the curve in the sense that these Sparplane and we have corporations with many German partners. They're really great because they would offer people, as you mentioned, really easy access to investing at quite low cost. And I think that is part of the solution if you want to fight the gap between rich and poor people. This will help. And obviously, it will take quite some years, but it will definitely help to decrease that gap. And in the Netherlands, it's also starting to pick up. I think the Dutch may be even more of a saving people than the Germans. So there's a lot of Dutch people that they have a savings account and they do have discipline there. But they still think investing is very dangerous.
Really?
So many of those, they actually aren't sort of secure enough to take that next step. And it's interesting that the local regulator in the Netherlands has actually done research earlier this year because they have always been warning for, well, bad investment products, which is a good thing. But they sort of neglected to mention that there's also good investment products. So with all these warnings, I think it sort of created a system where people, where at least some people automatically assume that investing is dangerous. You shouldn't do it. So they did this research. They found that there's in the Netherlands around 3 million people that should invest but don't. And to give you a bit of perspective, I think currently the Dutch population is around 18 million, so 1/8. So 3 million of those, that's like 15%. Could invest, but they don't. So now the regulator, together with Ministry of Finance, are starting to think about ways to change that. And one of the ways could be, and I'm not sure if they will do this, but it could be that they say, well, for certain investment products, the ones that are quite safe and have low cost, we'll do a different warning, or maybe no warning, maybe just some education to help people understand that investing, especially for the long term, is actually of benefit to them. And it's different than gambling, as some people think. So, but I think in other countries, it's still not as big as in Germany. So there's a lot of work to be done. Maybe we'll do some of it ourselves, because I do think it's really important that retail people get access to creation of wealth.
And do you experience something like the finfluencers, like people that talk about finance? Do you experience this kind of increasing of these topics on social media, maybe?
Yeah, definitely. And I think that's happening in probably most or even all of the European countries. On the one hand, I really like it because it will create an environment where more people get in touch with investing and can educate themselves. But there's also the downside that some of the influencers, they have ulterior motives. Sometimes they just want to sell something to their own benefit, and especially in the crypto scene, there were many many advantage examples there, and I think that's obviously one of the difficulties. I know that a lot of the European regulators are looking at this at the moment to see how can we sort of regulate the finfluencer community so that the quality of their information becomes better, and I think that that's important that they do that. It's also something that we've been looking at. So yeah, we really try to engage with finfluencers, but we also try to make sure that we find the finfluencers that really have an objective message and that really try to educate people. So yeah, I think we're seeing that more than 50% of the influencers actually does try to educate people, and without being biased because of some commercial model they have. But you have to be careful a little bit. So I'd say to the audience, don't trust everyone on the internet that has a message to share, because you still need to really sort of think about it yourself, and whether you really believe this person or whether this person may have a different motive. But in essence, I think it's a good thing. It does help to get more information to the audience.
Interesting. Yeah, this is kind of a big topic in Germany, or getting even bigger. And I think the German government, like the BaFin, is already looking at it pretty closely now. And maybe there are some new rules coming for
Did they already give you a call?
Oh, not yet. But I heard from others at this Finfluencer scene that they got a call with some advice that you have to make some points more clear, like always the disclaimer that you cannot tell something like, this is a good stock and it's a buy for myself. So this is kind of already not the way they want it. And you have to kind of say disclaimer, no financial advice and everything. So this is really a topic, and will probably be more of this next year. So let's see. Is there something like BaFin in Germany in the Dutch community too? Like, are they watching it also?
Yeah, they are, and they're actually also reaching out to the Finfluencer community, basically inviting them to a discussion.
Really?
And I know there have been a couple of discussions already, which I think is a good thing, especially the influencers that really like to give good information. They're also really open to what the regulatory people have to say, and I think one of the topics in the Netherlands, at least, is that you should always sort of have a balanced communication about both the rewards but also the risk. So if you're talking about an investment product only from let's say the rewards perspective, they don't like it. They really think you should also mention that any investment always carries some risk, and obviously the risk will become smaller if the investment is more diversified, for example. But it's important to mention. So yeah, if they are listening, our products as well, they have a certain amount of risk. But I think it, as an investor, you should always sort of look at the balance between the risk that you take and the reward that you can expect. And there's basically three rules that people can take in mind when they consider an investment. And that's basically, is it diversified enough, because the diversification will lower your risk? How is it with the cost? Because any cost you pay to an issuer of a product or your bank or broker is obviously taken out of your own profits. And then the way you trade the product, or maybe better, the way you not trade it, because buy and hold usually is the best strategy for investors in the long term. Trying to time the market or go in or out too much is usually not leading to good results. And then maybe even before those three rules, any investor should probably manage his or her own expectations before they start, in the sense that you should realize that you'll never be able to pick the right moment to start, and you'll also never pick the right moment to get out of the position. But as long as you realize that and you have a long-term perspective, you'll probably do okay. And it's also not really possible to pick the best product. Because if I mention it has to be well diversified, well, there's many different products that have that diversification. And in hindsight, it's always really easy to point, oh, that one did the best over the last 5 years. But that doesn't really say anything for the next 5 years. So yeah, those are just a couple of general comments on
True. Yeah, it's kind of like this overthinking, like you could probably find something that is a little bit more cheap and a little bit better performance. But in the end, what's really important is that you just start and then you will make your mistakes anyway. Like I think everyone who is 10 years at the stock market already experienced a lot of mistakes too. But the long term is then the most important. So this fits good to my last question, like how do you invest on your own? Which assets do we find in your portfolio, if you are allowed to tell it?
Yeah, I'm certainly allowed to tell it. As a matter of fact, I'm obliged to tell it. So if people would look at our annual report, they would see at least the positions from the board. So myself and Gijs, my co-director. So they're public information. So I think it's probably not a surprise that my investments consist of our own ETFs. Because, well, obviously it's like if you go to the butcher, if he doesn't eat his own meat, then you should probably worry a little bit. So without mentioning all of them, because I really do have almost all of them in my portfolio. But so my main ETFs in my portfolio are the global sustainable equal weight ETF and the high dividend ETF. So they're basically the core of my position. And then I have a number of the fixed income ETFs that I've added, especially over the last 6 months. I haven't been that invested in fixed income over the last years, but I think now it becomes a little bit more interesting again. I have pretty much all of the thematic ETFs, but then I have limited sort of that portion of the portfolio to, I think, roughly maybe 10 to 15% of the overall. So I think it's nice to have certain themes in the portfolio. But I also am mindful of the fact that it's really difficult to just pick one or two great themes because, yeah, that's just something that's really hard. So I rather have more of them and then in a smaller amount, and then basically have most of the portfolio in the broad market. I think that's what I really believe in the end. And the way I do it is basically whenever I have some free cash that is sort of above the, let's say, the buffer that anyone needs to have, because I think before you start investing, you should make sure that you at least have, let's say, a couple of month salaries in savings, so that if, I don't know, the washing machine breaks down or the car breaks down, you have at least something to, well, to fall back on. But anything above it, for the long term, you should probably invest it. And that's what I do. And sometimes people tell me, but how do you decide what the right time is?
When?
when? That's always the question, right? And I always tell people, there's no really perfect decision you can make there. So the best timing, I don't know, but I do know the worst timing. And the worst timing is postponing it, because there's always a reason not to invest. And I've actually seen people postponing for whatever reason. And then after years, they're still not invested. And I think that's the worst thing you can do, because then you will never put your money to work. And yeah, if you keep it on the savings account, it's not going to work for you. So yeah, at some point you should just do it. And that's basically something you said yourself as well. So I think we agree on that.
Okay. And you have everything in ETFs, like no single stocks around, only ETF? Or
I actually have one or two single stocks. And this is my... So when I used to be a trader, I also had equity in the trading firm, and I still kept it, at least some of it. And to me, that is almost like a hedge, because I think whenever the markets become really chaotic, and usually when they go down a lot, the trading firms, they tend to make more money than when the market is quiet. So the only two exceptions are, yes, two companies that are trading firms and that I have stock in. But that's mainly as sort of a hedge or insurance against volatile times on the exchange. But other than that, yeah, everything is in ETFs.
Okay, this was the last question for my interview. Thank you very much. Really interesting to get those insights and also some experience for myself doing this in English for the first time. It's really, I'm always thinking about the right words because I'm not that used to it, but I think we made a quite good job.
I think so. I think if we had done it in German, it would have been a lot more difficult for me, and I would probably not be able to express myself this well, which I regret because, well, I always like to have the local language approach. Aber mein Deutsch ist nicht ausreichend, glaube ich.
Maybe we do a part two in German, maybe now.
Or we can do it sort of bilingual. You can ask the questions in German and I can answer in English.
Could be,
we could do something.
Could be.
But in all honesty, I think your English is perfect. So I don't
Thank
think
you.
It's a big issue.
Okay. Thank you. So thanks for your time. And I'm already excited about the new products on next year.
Thanks. And thanks for having me. It was a lot of fun to be on.
Und wie vorhin auch kurz angesprochen, zum Abschluss natürlich der Disclaimer, die im Podcast besprochenen Themen stellen keine Anlageberatung oder auch Empfehlung oder auch steuerliche Beratung dar. Ihr handelt immer auf eure eigene Verantwortung, auf euer eigenes Risiko. Und ganz zum Schluss, wenn ihr bis zum Ende dabei geblieben seid, freut mich das umso mehr. Und ich freue mich auch immer riesig über Bewertungen. Das könnt ihr bei Spotify machen oder auch bei Apple Podcast oder natürlich auch bei YouTube. Bis zum nächsten Mal.